KPBS is supported by Bilhau Family of Companies, a family-owned business serving San Diego since 1980. Bilhau provides solutions for plumbing, heating, and air conditioning, flood, and restoration. Appointments may be scheduled 24/7 online or at 1-800-BILHAU, because we know how.
This week, San Diego County narrowly avoided more business closures and school reopening delays. The region's case rate placed us just below a threshold that would have triggered restrictions yet again. The back and forth over what can open and when has left San Diegans with many questions about reopening, and we asked you to share them with us. KPBS health reporter Taryn Mento collected our audience's questions and asked infectious disease specialist Dr. Christian Ramers to reply.
Dr. Ramers, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a lot of questions from our listeners. Let's see how many we can get in the next 10 minutes. Stephen Johnson asks, why are we not being told where the community outbreaks are located? He wonders why it's important to keep that information confidential when it could help people avoid contracting the virus.
It's a good question. It's one that the press has been asking the county officials really all along. And different counties have taken different approaches to this. For example, Los Angeles County, I think, is very public with where the outbreaks are occurring. The response that I've heard from the county officials, and again, I don't work at the county, but in speaking for them, they've said that it is difficult to get contact tracing information when you basically publicly post this information. And as soon as people feel scared to provide information, it makes that job a lot more difficult.
And I will say KPBS has obtained some of that information by zip code and published that, and we are part of a lawsuit that is against the county to provide more detailed information on the locations.
Right, so I've heard.
Our next question comes from listener Jacob Reimers.
Hi, guys. My name is Jacob Reimers, and my question was around the opening of movie theaters in San Diego. Are they open? I've heard that they're open, and if they are, do you have to wear a mask when you go?
Good question. So we are all learning as we go about what can be open and what can be closed, and maybe this is a good time to talk about the state's color-coded opening criteria. So, this is I would say, science-based approach to how we should open up our society versus not. We've seen over and over and over again in different countries, in different counties, that when you open up too fast, things get out of control. One of the real kickers that people don't talk about is the stuff we do today shows up in 2 to 3 weeks. And what everyone's worried about is things getting out of control and then not being able to pull things back because of something called exponential spread, where you have a real multiplication of those cases. So I'm bringing up the state criteria here. Movie theaters under the red tier, which we're currently in, say that they can be open with modifications at a 25% maximum capacity or 100 people, whichever is fewer. Now, they don't address masks, but in terms of any risk that you have, whether it be being on an airplane, being out in public, being in movie theaters, I personally think universal masking is a good idea. It's worked incredibly well, and there's great scientific data for it decreasing transmission in other settings.
Next, we'll hear from Mindy Hokazang. Here's her question.
Once a vaccine is approved, what would we expect rollout of the vaccine to look like? How long will it take? How will specific priority groups be determined? Who gets to decide what those look like? And at what point will vaccination coverage be considered high enough to allow for a broader reopening of activities?
Great question, Mindy. So a lot of people are thinking about this right now. I think you heard the CDC director, Robert Redfield, in front of Congress the other day alluding to this, that people just think it's going to be a switch that we flip and everybody gets the vaccine. That is not how it's going to happen. So there will be a limited amount of vaccine available in the beginning. And there are some very smart people thinking about how to phase this out. The one that I would refer you to is from the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, who's developed a very beautiful phased approach where phase 1, 2, 3, and 4, sort of allowing the populations at highest risk to go first. With a lot of data and a lot of thought behind this, they've used our experience with pandemic influenza preparedness, Ebola vaccine, all this kind of stuff, even smallpox. And there's basically a phase one that gets high-risk healthcare workers are first in line, as well as first responders, such as firefighters and policemen. Phase 1B would include everybody of all ages with comorbid and underlying conditions who are at the highest risk of dying of COVID. And then also included in phase one is older adults living in congregant settings, not specifically nursing facilities. Phase two brings in more essential workers, and there's a detailed explanation of what an essential worker is. That includes people like farm workers, people working in meatpacking plants, Teachers, definitely. Also people of all ages with comorbid conditions, people in homeless shelters and group homes and congregant settings not included earlier, such as prisons and jails. And then phase three gets more to the general population with young adults, children, other essential workers. Phase four would be everybody. Now the timeline of that obviously is gonna take a while. So even if we have 10 million doses by the end of the year, that's gonna go to healthcare workers first and then people with diabetes and hypertension or who are older, who have highest risk. And the last thing I'll say is that we are already starting locally to discuss this. How it actually rolls out will have to do with our existing systems with CDC and local health jurisdictions, but people are already starting to talk on the local level at San Diego County about how we're gonna roll this out. Final part of your question is, when do we get to herd immunity? The best modeling that I've seen is that we have to reach about 70% in order to have a real population effect of herd immunity. What does that mean? It means that the combination of having had COVID and having immunity from the actual infection, plus the number of people that get vaccinated, needs to reach about 70%. And I'll tell you the one thing I'm very, very concerned about, and everybody I know that's an infectious disease or public health doctor is concerned about this, is if we have enough vaccine hesitancy or reluctance of the population to get the vaccine, we may not get to that 70%. I've seen a recent survey that said 50% of Americans right now are prepared to get a vaccine. This is a moving target because, of course, it all depends on the transparency of the vaccine research protocols.
Thank you. So our next question comes from Laura Carr. Here it is.
How do we keep our kids and our families safe if and when schools reopen and require us, the kids, to go back to face-to-face?
Boy, this is a very complicated question. I don't know if I can answer it in 1 minute or less, but one major point I think has been lost a little bit and not emphasized enough is that school-based transmission is totally dependent on community-based transmission. Our schools are not isolated islands. They exist within communities. Students that go to school interact with older people who are their teachers, their administrators. They come home to older people who are their parents. They interact with their grandparents. A school is completely embedded in a community. And places where we've seen successful face-to-face school reintegration have been places that have already flattened the curve so much in the community that it looks like it's safer. The CDC recently issued a color-coded guide to say when it is safe to go back to school. And it does have to do with basically community transmission as the most important factor. I think it's a little bit arbitrary to choose what level of community transmission is safe enough, but the people at the CDC sort of chose actual thresholds there. So that I would say is the overall point of when we know it's safe.
This next question comes from a listener who's choosing to remain anonymous. They would like to know, can Dr. Reimers address the PCR cycle threshold being used in the labs that do San Diego County's tests and explain why it is considered precise enough to dictate public policy and business and school reopenings?
So let me start with what a PCR cycle threshold is. A PCR is a chemical reaction that amplifies very, very small amounts of DNA or RNA from a virus or a bacteria. The cycle threshold refers to how many of those cycles it takes to actually get a positive result. So the higher number you get, the lower amount of virus is actually there. What we've seen is that in people, for example, who get infected with COVID and they have a positive PCR test, if we were to test them after their infection, in many cases, it stays positive for weeks. 6 weeks, I had a patient who had an 8-week positive COVID test after being sick. And we know that person is probably not infectious. So the question is PCR too sensitive? And there's a lot of discussion about bringing in a different kind of test, like an antigen test, which really would only detect those who are very, very infectious at the initial rates of infection, versus a PCR, which really is a very, very sensitive test, and some people have said too sensitive. Now, I think the question is getting at maybe overcounting cases and counting positive PCRs as people that maybe don't necessarily have severe enough COVID, but really that's the standard test that we have right now, and PCR tests are really the best that we have. So they are the most sensitive and the most specific tests that we have right now. I will address the question and say that a positive PCR after somebody's already been diagnosed with COVID is pretty useless. We can actually not use that, but that's not used in the case count initially. It's just a single positive that tells us if somebody has COVID. You do not need to have a follow-up test once you've been positive once. We use days and symptoms, so 10 days and being symptom-free in terms of determining infectiousness.
The next question is one that we hear a lot, and this one comes from Chris Napis.
We're wondering why the kids haven't been a higher priority as all of the plans have sort of manifested. We're making all these innovations to allow restaurants to open outdoors and now indoors and to do all of these things. And just wondering why there hasn't been a more concerted effort to make things work for kids.
Boy, that's a really important question. I think in a cynical way, we would say that, you know, kids don't generate major economic productivity the way that bars and restaurants do. It's a philosophical question that I think we need to think about as a society. What's more important to us, open bars or open schools?
Well, we have run out of time. Thank you, Dr. Raymer, so much for your expertise and taking the time to answer these questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
KPBS On Demand is made possible by the Spreckles Organ Society, continuing the tradition of concerts from Balboa Park online every Sunday at 2 p.m. New online webcasts are now available Sundays at 2 p.m. at balboaparkconcerts.org.